Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Those of you who've been listening to this program know that one of the things that is of abiding concern to me in that war is the vulnerability of our electric grid. I consider it really a kill shot for our enemies, and have for quite some time now been trying to use such tools as I have and persuasive powers as I can muster and others with whom I've been able to work to try to raise awareness about this vulnerability and to effect the kind of corrective action that I believe is eminently doable, but as yet not done. No one, I believe, has done more in a shorter period of time to raise awareness and to engage the political leadership of this country on this very serious problem than our guest. I am absolutely delighted to have him. He is Ted Koppel, a man whose renown as a journalist precedes him. He is an award-winning journalist many times over. In fact, the list of awards is too many to mention in the time we have available. But suffice it to say, he's received 37 Emmys for his journalism. But I think he's really deserving of the Medal of Freedom for this particular work, which is a new book entitled Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. Ted Koppel, you do us great honor to join us. Thank you for this real public service and for the chance to talk with you a little bit about it.
Well, Frank, you and I have known each other for a very long time. Usually we were on other sides of the microphone, but I'm pleased to be here with you today.
Well, as am I. Let me talk first and foremost about kind of the threat as you've come to understand it. How did you get into this in the first place, and how serious do you consider the threat to be?
Well, the fact of the matter, Frank, is I am anything but a techno geek. And what drew my attention to it was really a bunch of our political leaders who raised the issue, not the least of them the president, who twice in the State of the Union addresses made reference to the danger to our infrastructure and singling out the power grid and the danger of a cyber attack on the power grid. Leon Panetta, who at the time was Secretary of Defense, when he spoke of the danger of a cyber attack being the equivalent of a cyber Pearl Harbor. Janet Napolitano, who just before she stepped down as Secretary of Homeland Security, gave a speech at the National Press Club in which she warned about it. And my attention, Frank, was drawn by the fact that despite these alarms being raised by very senior officials in the government, really very little was being written about it. And there was almost no political reaction to it. So having been a reporter for a very long time, my nose started to twitch a little, and I thought there may be a story here.
There is indeed a story here, and you could add to that list of things that are peculiar the fact that with that level of interest at the highest of levels of the government, very little was being done about it as well. You, of course, focus expressly on the threat of cyber attack to the grid, Ted Koppel. And yet you do make reference to some of the other ways in which adversaries of this country could seek to do us harm. Let's just tick those off in addition to cyber, and then we'll come back to the use of computer weapons against us. What other concerns do you have in terms of vulnerabilities to the grid to other kinds of attack?
Well, I mean, let's go to the other end of the technology scale. The simplest way of taking out at least part of a power grid is to go after the large power transformers, which tend to sit out in the open, usually behind a chain link fence, but easily accessible and vulnerable to gunfire. And there was a case where I believe it was either 17 or 19 power transformers were taken out in the middle of the night by a group still unknown. It has to be more than one person because there were heavy lids that had to be lifted to enable these people to get access to communications gear, to cut the wires of that communications gear. A SEAL team that came in after the fact to examine what had been done came to the conclusion that this was a highly trained team of professionals using AK-47 fire and knocking out these 17 transformers. As it turned out, that particular substation belonging to PG&E out in California was only offline for a little more than a couple of weeks. And during that time, there were other substations able to take up the load. But the fear of some of the investigators was that this was merely a dry run, and that if you had more than one of these teams going after more than one of the substations at the same time, they could have caused incalculable damage.
And as you've observed, Ted, in this instance, had they not missed that one communications link that enabled the offsite control center to power down those transformers, we might have lost them and with them the power for Silicon Valley for perhaps years. It takes that long to replace these things. So you're absolutely right. This is a very, very clear and present danger. You also talk in the book about the threat of electromagnetic pulse.
Just one more point, Frank. When you talk about the, the difficulty of replacing these, I think your listeners need to understand these are enormous transformers. They weigh between 400,000 and 600,000 pounds. They are not interchangeable. They're custom made, and very, very few of them are made in the United States. Most are made overseas. If you order one, from the time you order it, but a company orders it, until delivery time, it can take anywhere from 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, they're essentially hand-built, and I think, again, very few of us appreciate how much is riding on those very, very vulnerable assets. Let me just ask you about electromagnetic pulse. I know that you've sort of suggested that this may be a low probability but very serious threat. You describe very well in your book, Lights Out, a scenario that has been validated, I think, by a congressional commission, among others. Talk a little bit about that and why that's also of concern.
Well, an electromagnetic pulse is probably best known to readers of a novel. The book was called One Second After. William Fortune, who wrote that book, I think, drew rather heavily on the findings of this congressional commission, which was formed in 2004 and I think kept up its study and its work until 2008. What we're talking about here is an alien power. I don't mean aliens as in Martian. I mean someone meaning armed with the United States setting off a nuclear device 20 or 30,000 feet above the United States. And the resultant electromagnetic pulse would effectively knock out all electronic devices pretty much across the country. The reason I believe that to be among the less likely dangers that we face is because it would take very little time for the United States to establish who had done this act and therefore to be able to respond, and to respond rather dramatically. The difference between that and a cyber attack on the United States, and what is the greatest danger of all, is that a cyber attack is likely to be launched, and it could be weeks or months before we have the slightest clue as to who was behind it.
Yeah. Those are very interesting, I think perhaps somewhat debatable points, but the truth of the matter is we may, if we were crippled in the kind of way that you've described in Lights Out, may not be in a position to do that kind of forensic work, let alone take the kind of retributory action that that might be in order. Ted Koppel is our guest. He has graciously agreed to allow us to have another segment with him, and we're going to talk a little bit more about what can be done about this vulnerability arising from an electric grid that never was designed to be resilient and certainly isn't at the moment. That and more with the author of Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath, Ted Koppel. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is multi award-winning journalist Ted Koppel. We're talking with him about a subject near and dear to my heart and now evidently very much near and dear to his. And it should be, in fact, to all of us. It will affect our future in the most dramatic way if it goes bad. His book is called Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. And Ted, you've laid out very nicely the vulnerabilities of the grid. There's another one we won't have time to get into today of this solar storm or geomagnetic disturbance piece. But I would like to ask you about how we got here, how we got to a point where something that is so indispensable, the most critical of critical infrastructures, the electric grid of the United States, is really so exposed to these various sorts of threats. What's your sense of that?
Well, as you know, Frank, until fairly recently, there was almost no regulation governing the electric power grids and the electric power industry. And even to this day, and we're going to get into a little, acronym game here with FERC and NERC, NERC being the North American Electric Reliability Council, that's the industry group, and FERC being the federal organization that, in theory, has some control. In reality, it's a lot less than it seems to be. We have a curious situation here where the industry has to approve by a two-thirds majority proposals for legislation made by the federal agency. So we have this extraordinary situation where an industry decides just what regulations it's willing to accept.
But, you know, when you say that, Ted, I think most people will think, if they know anything of our history, back to, the trust-busting era when we decided that self-regulating industries was really not a good plan. How could we possibly be allowing this to happen with this one that is so absolutely critical to our survival?
Well, what's happened with the deregulation of the industry from a commercial point of view, as is so often the case, deregulation does lead to market forces taking control. But as a result of deregulating the electric power industry, we now have 3,200 electric power companies out there. The big ones are relatively well protected. Nobody is perfectly protected, but they spend a great deal of money on cybersecurity. The smaller ones do not, and all of them are interconnected, so that if someone gets into one of these smaller power companies and they have spent, and I don't want to make it sound too easy, as you know, Frank, an attack on the power grid, at least a cyber attack, is a terribly complicated piece of work. But the Chinese are inside the grid. The Russians are inside the grid. They have the capacity to take down all or part of the grid, quite literally at a moment's notice.
There was a report conducted by one of the outfits that does sort of forensic reverse hacking called Cylance back in the fall of last year. And they said the Iranians were inside our grid as well. And I'm assuming the North Koreans are if they are. So this is really a yawning problem. And I guess what you're saying, if I understand you rightly, is that the utilities have optimized for profit, obviously, but also to provide reliable power. And they do a pretty darn good job of that when all is said and done, the odd storm notwithstanding. It's just that they've never been required or even really incentivized to provide resiliency as well. Is that right?
Well, they would argue that they have resiliency, but I would say to you, because of the 3,200 companies, what people need to understand about the generation and delivery of electric power is there has to be a perfect balance between the amount of electricity that is generated and the amount of electricity that is delivered and used. The only thing that is capable of maintaining that kind of perfect balance in this day and age with that many different companies is the Internet. And the Internet, as you well know, was never designed to be protected. It's almost impossible to superimpose on a mechanism like the Internet, which was never designed to be defended, a perfect defense.
Again, our guest is Ted Koppel, a journalist of great renown, a man I'm recommending for the Medal of Freedom for his new book, Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared and Surviving the Aftermath. Ted, one of the things that I'm happy to report is that we have had a piece of legislation that bears on all of this approved by the House of Representatives just the day before yesterday. It is the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. It would go some way to getting us started on the process of figuring out what our vulnerabilities are in this area and taking corrective action. It's more of, again, a strategy for going there rather than actually doing it. But one of the things that you focus on at some length in the book is preparedness. And I'd like to ask you about that. Is it at the end of the day possible, given what you now know about the horrific consequences, societal as well as for many, many millions of us, of the grid going down and staying down for any length of time, possible really adequately to prepare for such a contingency?
Well, the key word, of course, as you know, Frank, is adequately. But the fact of the matter is the mere act of preparation. Let me take you back to something in which you have a great deal of personal experience, the nuclear balance between the United States and the Soviet Union. You know that during the 1950s and into the 60s, all kinds of preparations were made in this country, which in the final analysis and in the Soviet Union were pointless. The plans for evacuation, the plans for bomb shelters, the mere fact that we came to the conclusion, we and the Soviets, that those plans would not work, led ultimately to what we now have, this program of mutual assured destruction, where there is this balance of terror, which sounds terrible, but has kept the world from any kind of nuclear war for more than half a century now.
Well, this is a subject for a much longer conversation, if you'll indulge me. But I think what you're calling for in your book, if not in so many words, is really a return both to personal responsibility for preparedness, but also an effort to be made by the society in light of what the stakes are here. But really, my guess is when all is said and done, Ted Koppel, we're going to have to address seriously how we prevent such a nightmare from befalling us rather than try to remediate our way out of it should it happen.
I think we have to do both, Frank. I think it would be naive in the extreme. I mean, you began to list, in addition to the Chinese and the Russians, those who might be in the grid, and you added the Iranians. And as you go down the list of those countries, as we have fewer and fewer common interests, we do have common interests with the Chinese. We even have common interests with the Russians. None at all with a group like ISIS. When you have a group like ISIS launching a cyber attack against any part of the U.S. infrastructure, I think you have to be prepared, not only in terms of trying to prevent it from happening, but proactively dealing with the consequences in the event that they succeed. I would like to make just one further point. I don't know whether your politics and mine are the same. I would like to suggest that in this particular interest, the vulnerability of the power grid, it should not be a partisan issue. It shouldn't be conservatives versus liberals, Democrats versus Republicans. It's critically important that we come to realize that whatever differences we may have, we have a common interest in securing the grid insofar as that is possible and preparing for the likelihood that it will be attacked.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. In fact, I call this the ultimate transpartisan issue, and keeping it from getting into the ditch of partisan politics is a full-time job, but it's one that's been made considerably easier by this really signal contribution you've made. Ted Koppel, Lights Out, a cyber attack, a nation unprepared, surviving the aftermath. I don't know if my recommendation will get you anywhere near a Medal of Freedom, but I'm going to continue to pursue it. Thank you, sir, for your time. And next up, we'll talk with a congressman who's been working hard on this problem, Congressman Randy Weber from the great state of Texas, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This morning, French military personnel and police engaged in firefights with heavily armed and suicide bomb-wielding jihadists in a suburb of Paris called Saint-Denis. That neighborhood has long been designated by the French government as one of more than 750 areas in its nation called sensitive urban zones. Such zones are largely populated by unassimilated Muslim immigrants. Increasingly, they have been effectively off-limits to those who don't adhere to the Islamic supremacists' Sharia code. Colloquially, they're called no-go zones. These enclaves and others like them across Europe are ticking time bombs. Even before hundreds of thousands more fighting-age Muslim men began migrating to the continent this year, Western authorities had reason to fear the jihadism fostered inside such no-go zones. A day of reckoning has long been expected. That frightening moment may be at hand. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by a man I've come to admire greatly for his service in the United States House of Representatives. He is Congressman Randy Weber. He represents the people of the 14th District of Texas. He serves on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, where he chairs its Energy Subcommittee, quite importantly. Also on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, he's a member of the subcommittees on the Middle East, North Africa, and also Europe, Asia, and emerging threats. Well, that just about covers the whole planet, doesn't it, Congressman? Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
It's so good to have you with us, especially as I'd really like to take the opportunity to publicly thank you for your leadership in a very important initiative that I think may be a game changer with respect to one of those emerging threats, which we've talked about before, which is the vulnerability of the electric grid. Would you talk a little bit about your congressional delegation letter to your governor, Governor Abbott?
This letter that we sent to Governor Abbott about our grid, and as you're aware, Frank, you know, Texas is pretty much has its own electrical grid. About 85% of the state is in what we call ERCOT, Electric Reliability Council of Texas, grid. And so Texas being a big place and lots of manufacturing going on, and I would argue arguably the one of the brightest industrial spots, manufacturing spots in the country, if not the brightest. So very, very important that the grid is protected. Of course, we sent a letter to Governor Abbott. Most all of our Texas delegation signed on, imploring him to go ahead and implement the legislation they passed, which highlighted the fact that the vulnerability of the grid, because the last thing we want to do is have a grid taken down. And very encouraged from what we're hearing. Of course, as you pointed out, State Senator Bob Hall from Texas has been working on it as well. Sounds like we're going to get that traction. Sounds like the governor is on board, and they're going to go to work to make this a priority. And rightfully so. You may not be aware of this, Frank. You know, we like to say things are bigger and better in Texas. Of course, this is not necessarily one of the records you would strive to go after. But about 50%, more than 50% of the casualties in the war on terror come from our Texas veterans. So Texas is indeed not only important to the manufacturing sector of the United States economy, but even the national security sector of the
United States. So. I was unaware of that statistic. That is chilling. Congressman Randy Weber, we were speaking with Ted Koppel in the previous segments about the various threats to the grid. And again, I salute you for your leadership on this. As you look at the federal sort of side of the story, I was very pleased to see as well that you and your colleagues approved this week the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act as a comparable measure, really, to what may come out of Governor Abbott's initiative. But all of these are really timely, and especially against the backdrop of what we've been seeing in terms of terrorist threats around the world. And maybe I could pivot to that. Your takeaway from what went down in Paris last Friday and what happened earlier today over there in connection with trying to round up some of the suspected perpetrators.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. Obviously, a tragedy last Friday. Our hearts, thoughts, and prayers go out to the people, the victims and their families in France. It simply points out the enemies around, our enemies around the world that hate us, hate freedom, hate liberty, and hate the West, which is, you know, just as an aside, one of the reasons why our infrastructure, our energy infrastructure is so important. We've got to be equipped to fight, and we need power to be able to do that. But now we have a president who wants to bring in, it depends on whose numbers you're listening to, anywhere upwards of 20,000 Syrian refugees. Yesterday, I said in a classified briefing with the FBI, Department of Defense, and Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, FBI Director James Comey, and the State Department. And, of course, I can't reveal specifics from classified briefings, but I will tell you that I walked away from that briefing with the feeling that, you know what, we absolutely do not have a thorough vetting process. Now, a lot of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are saying, well, America's always been a welcoming country. You know, we're founded by immigrants, and blah, 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 blah. But I think one thing they're forgetting, Frank, is that we live in a different time now. You know, when immigrants came over, when they fled, even World War II, when some of the Jewish folks came over from the area of Germany to flee prosecution, you know, they didn't stow away terrorists in their group. Now we live in a day and age when you've got terrorists who are exporting terror in the way of suicide bombers who hate us. And by all accounts, even by the FBI director and by some others who've been watching this, they expect ISIL and others to infiltrate these refugee camps.
Well, they say they're going to do that, so it doesn't surprise me that they would. But this is such an important and very timely conversation, Congressman, because as you know, the president is doubling down on this. He's insisting that they can vet these folks. He's insisting that anybody who says we must put a pause in place on bringing in more until we've figured out how to do a vetting, which is clearly needed. And I just wonder, I know you're a co-sponsor of legislation that the Homeland Security Chairman Michael McCaul, one of your colleagues from Texas and one of the co-signers of that letter, he's introduced. But I gather the next opportunity really to do something along these lines of suspending further refugee resettlement until this is sorted out is a defunding initiative on the omnibus. Do you see that as in prospect, and is that the way to go?
Well, I hope so. I hope the House of Representatives will finally man up and use the power of the purse. You know, there was a little upheaval here recently.
Yeah, I noticed.
leadership was not willing to use the power of the purse. And look, Americans are tired of this, and Americans are tired of the way the Republican-led House and Senate's not been doing their job. And you can prove that with two words, Donald Trump. You know, they want to change. They want somebody that'll man up and speak their language. And let me just back up a little bit. People wonder what difference it makes. You remember Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifying in the committee said that, you know, about Benghazi? What difference does it make? You know, we got four dead Americans at this point. What difference does it make? And I would tell people, you know, that this is the difference it makes, because we got enemies around the world who not only hate us, Americans expect and deserve a government that shoots straight with them. And shoots even straighter at our enemies.
It doesn't let them shoot straight at us was kind of the point.
Absolutely. And if we don't identify the enemy, and if we refuse to say that Islamic extremism is our enemy, that somehow, you know, you go back to Major Nadal Hassan in Texas, killed 13 people, actually 14, one of the girls was pregnant, and called it workplace violence. Now, there's a guy, Frank, who was, wouldn't you think, moving up the military into the rank of major, that he was thoroughly vetted, quote unquote?
Well, in point of fact, as I think you know, Congressman Weber, he was doing everything he could to make known his intentions to his comrades, and some of them actually, you know, warned their higher ups of what was going down.
Absolutely.
So this really is a prime example of the willful blindness that you're speaking of.
So when you go back and you look at some of these Democrats, including Hillary Clinton and the President Barack Obama, it's almost as if, as you just stated, they willingly turn a blind eye toward this and say, you know, it can't be that bad. Well, yeah, Madam Secretary, it is that bad. And yes, it does make a difference.
And it's going to get worse if we're not careful. It's
going to get worse.
Congressman, and again, you've been going to school on this. You've been getting your classified briefings. You've, of course, been participating in these oversight hearings in your various committees. Is there any question in your mind that America is in the crosshairs of these guys, these jihadists? And if so, that it is incumbent upon everybody who's taken the oath of office that you've sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic?
Well, that's absolutely accurate. Of course, there's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of days. Our great governor, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, and some, what, 29 or 30 others, have publicly stated they won't allow Syrian refugees into their states. And I've had some of my colleagues cross the aisle say, well, they don't have that power. You know, Congress, this is a federal issue. And I have reminded them, I said, look, if you've got a federal government that's letting you down and abdicating its responsibility to first and foremost protect Americans, thank God for governors like Greg Abbott and others who will stand up at the state level and say, look, if the federal government won't do its job to protect Americans, uphold the Constitution, we will. And so I don't think you've seen the end of this yet. I think you'll see more governors get on board. I think you see the discussion go. And I'm hoping, quite frankly, to your point and your question, that we actually, Congress works to defund everything the White House through the State Department is trying to do to bring these Syrian refugees in, that among them very well may be terrorists.
Indeed. Congressman Randy Weber, we have to let you go. I know. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to join us today and for the important work that you're doing. Most especially, I'm grateful on those emerging threats. Keep it up, sir. Come back to us again soon. John Bolton joins us. We'll get his take on many of these issues as well. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a great privilege to be able to welcome once again our friend and colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, Ambassador John Bolton. He is today a senior fellow there, but he's served in many other capacities in our government at the highest levels, including most recently as the U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations. He's been an Undersecretary of State for Arms Control. He's worked in various other agencies of the Department of State and the Justice Department. He is the go-to man. You find him at Fox. You find his books in all the right bestseller lists. Surrender is not an option. And occasionally, I'm very pleased to say, you find him here. John Bolton, thank you for finding a few minutes. Good to catch up with you, sir.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank. Glad to be with you again.
So we've had this heinous attack in Paris today. There have been repercussions in one of the banlieues, the so-called zones, urbaines sensibles. Others have just simply called them no-go zones. What do you make of what's happening now inside this important allied country, John Bolton?
Well, I think the tragedy on Friday has woken them up to the risks they've been facing for some time. And while the raid overnight appears to have been partially successful, I think it's a testimony to the depth and breadth of the terrorist organization that's not just in Paris but all over Europe, and that has been strengthened in recent weeks and months by this incredible flow of refugees out of the Middle East. I think that ISIS has demonstrated in just a relatively short period of time, a couple weeks, they've blown a Russian passenger plane out of the sky. They've conducted terrorist attacks in Beirut, killing over 40 people. They've conducted the tragic attacks in Paris this past Friday. And just in Germany yesterday, a soccer match was postponed where they had credible threats of another terrorist attack with the possibility of Chancellor Angela Merkel being present, as French President Hollande was present on Friday night at the French National Stadium. So these are attacks, I think, at least in part, aimed not just at generalized terrorism, but maybe direct assassination attacks. And while the United States is obviously further away from the ISIS base of operations in Syria and Iraq, it's not that much farther away in technological terms. So I think we'd better be very serious about being on the alert for a possible attack here in the near future.
And John, let me just ask you, because it's again, much in evidence with today's operations in Paris. It's not just these folks coming in from outside. Refugees is an issue we'll come back to in a moment, but it is also the extent to which there really is now, as you sort of alluded to, an infrastructure for jihadism in most, if not virtually all, of the countries of Europe, most especially those in Western Europe. What should the Europeans, and for that matter, we, be taking away from the insights of the past couple of days with regard to them?
Well, I think this is a critical point. You know, the law enforcement authorities in France have said that they estimate there were something like 8 shooters or suicide bombers who carried out all of these attacks in Paris last Friday. But it's clear that that was just the teeth, and that they had support structures with God only knows how many other people involved. And at least some of those attackers were able to escape and disappear into the suburbs that you referred to. There were reports some had made it all the way through the country into Belgium and perhaps elsewhere in Europe. And it's that domestic support network tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who have come from North Africa and the Middle East before that can provide the ocean in which the terrorists swim. And, you know, we've seen the Europeans not paying attention to the people coming into their country. Germany, I think, has made a catastrophic mistake in recent weeks by allowing, now they're saying they're prepared to see 1.5 million Syrian refugees come to Germany. We should not make that mistake in the United States, and I think we need to step up law enforcement activity to resume the levels that we had after 9/11. There aren't any safe zones in this country yet, and there shouldn't be. It's not that we're trying to interfere with anybody's freedom of religion, but you have no right to plot terrorist attacks in a church, a synagogue, or a mosque.
John, you've touched on this other issue, which is, of course, very much in the headlines at the moment, and that is the president's seeming doubling down on his determination, by some estimates, to bring 200,000 people, not all of them from Syria or the Middle East, for that matter, but many of them from there. And it seems a disproportionate percentage of them being Muslims, and therefore quite possibly among the problem set that you're talking about. Are you of the view that we should have a pause at a minimum on this kind of importation of potentially further problems?
No, I think that's right. I think the president has just been flatly dishonest in his approach to this question, and also ironically hypocritical. I mean, here's a president who talks endlessly about international law. You know, there actually is an international treaty that deals with refugee questions. And while this is a broad and complex subject, let me just make one point. Most of these people who are flooding into Europe now do not qualify for refugee status under the applicable international treaty. treaties and under American domestic law. To be a refugee, to apply for asylum in a country like the United States, you have to show a well-founded fear of persecution because of your religion, your political beliefs, your race, or your ethnicity. Now, I think there are populations in the Middle East who can show that, the Christians that ISIS is trying to wipe out, the Yazidis and others. But for all of these other hundreds of thousands of people, certainly they're displaced because of war. Certainly their situation is unfortunate. But they're not being persecuted by ISIS on account of their religion or their political beliefs or their ethnicity. So, it's not even – you don't even get to refugee – to monitoring or vetting the refugees because they don't count as refugees. They ought to be in camps in Turkey and Jordan. We should certainly provide humanitarian assistance to them, but we are under no legal and no moral obligation to bring that kind of person into the United States under the international treaties to which we're a party. It is basic refugee doctrine that the refugees themselves are better off being repatriated to their own homes or their own regions, where they're comfortable, where they've got networks of friends and family and opportunities for work. Far better to seek repatriation when the time is right than resettlement, which disrupts their families, puts them into foreign, unknown environments. And the people themselves would be better off staying in their homes or in their regions. Instead, I think Turkey punted this problem to Europe. The Germans exacerbated it by opening their borders. Europe's going to pay a terrible price for this. We should learn the lesson. We do not have to pay the price here, and we can still fulfill our humanitarian reputation, and well-deserved it is, by providing food and clothing and shelter to the refugees where they are.
Yeah, this is an eminently sensible approach. I hope that such reason will prevail. John, we're certainly seeing governors across the country, we're seeing legislators in Congress on both sides of the aisle really beginning to hew to this line, but it certainly is being resisted by the president, among many other mistakes that he's making. I'm sorry to say we don't have time to explore them at greater length at the moment, John, but I hope you'll come back to me. I did want to just do a shout out for the event you're going to be doing tomorrow, I believe, at the American Enterprise Institute on the balance of power in Asia and the U.S. versus China struggle that is emerging there. It's a fascinating topic and one that I look forward to having a chance to discuss with you. Could you give us just 30 seconds on that?
Well, we'll be joined by Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, who obviously brings an important perspective to it, and talking about, I think, the big picture that too many people in government, and I'll be candid, too many people in business have simply missed about the potential threat that China poses for us. We can see what they're doing in the South China Sea, but it's a threat to Taiwan. It's a threat because of cyber warfare. It's a threat across a whole range of capabilities, and I think people need a better sense of it.
They do indeed. We appreciate your acumen on that as well. John, come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with John Rossimondo of the Investigative Project on Terrorism about this threat within. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us. Friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, we've had a rather important series of conversations about various threats to this country. It's something we focus on intensively here at Secure Freedom Radio. I'm very pleased to have with us for the cleanup batter on this program, John Rossimondo, a professional investigative reporter who is now a senior analyst with the highly acclaimed Investigative Project on Terrorism, founded and run by my friend and colleague Stephen Emerson. John, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
You've been doing some very important reporting on a problem that we've sort of touched on at several points along the trail today, namely the fact that these jihadists have the United States very much in their crosshairs, too. This is not just a problem for the Middle East or for Europe or for other parts of the free world, but for us here at home as well. And John, one of the things that I know you've been very much engaged in, as has the Investigative Project on Terrorism, is the piece of this very complex picture that isn't so much the violent kind of jihad as what I think of as the pre-violent kind. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
Well, you have groups in this country that are Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups that actively fight CARE, ICNA, ISNA. Spent a lot of time lobbying the administration and Congress to stop paying attention to Islamic extremists in the name of civil rights. They cry about FBI stings and saying that the FBI has created most of the terrorists, when the terrorists themselves are putting together manuals telling their jihadis how to avoid getting caught. Then you have Islamophobia saying that, you know, if anybody who talks about this is a bigot, a hater. So they have their bases covered, because what they want to do is shut down our security apparatus so that it's so cowed that they can pretty much do whatever they like. They don't pay attention to the connections between different members of the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS or Al-Qaeda. They just want to downplay it, such as when Anwar al-Awlaki was in Yemen, he lived in safe houses provided by the Yemeni Brotherhood. And you have reports now that Khayrat al-Shatter, who is a senior member of the Egyptian Brotherhood, has been involved in funding Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, which is now ISIS in Sinai, which was responsible for blowing up the Russian airliner.
So these guys are not nonviolent. This is kind of the point about describing them as pre-violent, because really this is just the prelude to what they would prefer to do, which is the most effective, terrifying kind of jihad, namely the murderous kind. But, John, you've come across in your investigative reporting a manual which describes for the jihadists who are of the violent stripe how best to operate in countries like ours. Talk, if you would, a little bit about what that manual tells us about the sort of tradecraft that they're using against us.
It's a 64-page manual that I was provided through a source on Twitter that goes into detail on how to stay under the radar. There's been a lot of talk since the Paris attacks about how these guys go under the radar. One thing that's become standard for ISIS is telling its people how to use things like encrypted web browsers, text apps that messages to self-destruct, operating systems for their computers that are encrypted. And one thing that I noticed was the organization, the precision of these attacks. One thing that
these are the ones in Paris you're speaking of.
Yes, these are the ones in Paris. I mean, after, it's kind of ironic that this happened a couple of days after I finished writing my article, because I was cued into other tactics. They instruct the leaders of their cells not to tell their jihadis what they're up to, and only wait until the operation is in progress before informing them. Plus, also, another thing that's disturbing about this manual is it goes in and analyzes failed terrorist operations, the ones that were broken up by the FBI or by Western intelligence, to tell them what not to do, tell them to test their bombs before they go and execute their operations, tell them to test the weapons. Plus, also, it provides instructions for safe houses, how to make the safe house look inconspicuous until after they've sort of completed their mission.
John, talk a little bit, if you would, about what you also have tumbled upon, which is that amidst these migrations of Sunni Muslims, some of whom it appears have ties to the various jihadist groups in that sect, there are also some that have ties to Iran and may have a similar murderous purpose in mind as well.
Well, I was alerted about a month or two ago about an onslaught of Shiite militiamen belonging to different factions in Iraq, such as Sadr's militia, that were trained by the Iranian Republican Guard Corps. And they were making their way through Turkey into the Balkans. And a few of them I traced all the way to Finland. And these guys were proud to post pictures of themselves on their Facebook pages. And one thing that I wasn't aware of is that there's been an influx of Shiite foreign fighters from Sweden and other places across Europe. And one thing we know is that Hezbollah has a rather extensive social network that these guys could potentially plug themselves into. And these guys are all fanatically loyal to Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Yeah, this is not a good thing, needless to say, especially if they're able to further migrate from Europe, where they've apparently managed to find safe haven, to this country. And John, you're hearing a lot of talk. We've been discussing it in the course of the program with members of Congress, John Bolton and others, about this idea of becoming more rigorous about our vetting of these refugees. Some of these may not be coming in as refugees. Mightn't they just come in as visitors or on a tourist visa of some kind and thereby get into this country capable, fully capable of waging the violent kind of jihad here as well?
I think that it's a decided risk. One of the things that really worries me is the reports that came up after the Sardia brothers conducted the Boston bombing that stated that they were missed because of problems with our terrorism databases. My understanding is that, say, Homeland Security might have some information that state doesn't have, or CIA might have information that FBI or vice versa. And, you know, if you have everything, the information in the U.S. government compartmentalized, if you have State Department people over there interviewing these guys to get a visa, a visa or asylum to come to the U.S., they're not going to have that information. So before we just even talk about, you know, letting these people in, we need to find out what our weaknesses are and address them the way that we did after 9/11 when we came out with the Department of Homeland Security.
John, we have to let you go. Thank you. I'm so grateful for what you and Steve Emerson and Pete Hoekstra and others at the Investigative Project on Terrorism do, and you're joining us from time to time. Keep up that good work, and we'll look forward to talking with you in the near future. Look forward to talking to the rest of you again, I hope tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afte. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.